directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, chaps. Lionel, where are we?
We're in a studio location in central London. In a studio, it's very...
Secret bunker.
Secret bunker, isn't it? Yeah, it's not our usual hustle-bustle cafe environment, is it? It's a bit unnerving at the moment.
The sound of sort of smug £2.80 cappuccinos being... What do you do? You don't brew a cappuccino.
Flat whites, if you don't mind. I can maybe give you a bit of a squeaky chair. You've got the yellow microphone, I noticed, Lionel.
I have,
any
yeah.
Any significance to that?
Just means best podcaster. Daniel's got the green microphone, most consistent daily podcaster. And you've got the red microphone, Spanish podcaster.
Hey, amigos. Okay, well, let's kick off a shorter than usual podcast this week, because this week also sees the launch of our first Friends special podcast. All of those who have signed up to become a friend of the podcast will receive, or will have received, a password to access the special Behind the Bunker podcast. And our first one of these will be monthly. And the first one is a Team Sky special, in which we look back on the first 5 years of Team Sky and a little bit towards the future as well, but generally speaking, poring over what has gone on at Team Sky over the first 5 years of their existence. And we have interviews with Chris Froome, Nicholas Roach, and a little bit from Sir Dave Brailsford as well.
Yeah, if you haven't signed up yet to become a friend of the podcast...
Why not?
...do so. Very easy to do. www.thecyclingpodcast.com. Click on the link, Become a Friend. You can pay via PayPal, which is trustworthy and very easy to use. And it's...
Straight into Lionel's bank account.
It goes straight into my bank account, and then I give Daniel and Richard 50 pence each, if they're good boys.
Yeah, well, you did tell us there's a big commission, a big PayPal commission. I guess that's what that's all about. But no, thank you very much, all of those who have already signed up as friends. We really appreciate it, and we've been quite overwhelmed by the response to that. And if you haven't, then please do. It's very easy. So for this shorter than usual podcast, chaps, we've got a couple of races to talk about. The Dubai Tour, won by Mark Cavendish, and he won two stages as well. Daniel, what's more significant, winning two bunch sprints or winning the overall?
It's a good question. I mean, people might quibble with the way in which he won the sprints. It wasn't the sort of the dominant Cavendish of a few years ago, winning by several bike lengths, although he actually did wrap up the race quite easily on the final stage, which was really due to very good timing of the lead out. They went very, very early, he and Renshaw. But, I've thought a lot about this, and we talked last week about how Cavendish perhaps lost some speed and why he's lost some speed and the role of the team in that. He made no secret, well, initially at the start of his career, of the fact that he would probably lose speed. He always felt that, and that's down to the kind of sprinter that he is. He's a sprinter that relies a lot on leg speed, etc. And over the course of a sprinter's career, they are basically deconditioning themselves to sprint fast, because they spend 10 seconds of their day every day at most sprinting, and they spend 6 hours riding at sort of 35 kilometres an hour. So sprinters do lose speed, particularly those that rely on leg speed. The ones that tend to last a long time, the ones who rely a lot on power, which is why sort of Pataki went on for a long time, Cipollini. So he always said that he was going to lose speed, but he also always said that he wanted to become a more versatile rider. You know, he's definitely done that, and by getting better in the climbs. We saw him on the hilltop finish, not losing a great deal of time to John Degenkolb.
And that was steep. I mean,
that was
very
steep. Yeah, and you know, any guy who is able to do that, they're not going to be necessarily as well. In Cavendish's case, he's probably not going to be as fast as he once was. I mean, we sort of get a bit misty-eyed about, you look back at those sprints in 2007 when he was a neo-pro, 2008, 2009, when his acceleration was just like nothing we'd ever seen before. But he wasn't really getting over hills. And, you know, I think in sport you want to see the supreme exponent of any particular art. And for Cavendish, that was the acceleration. That was 200 metres out, 250 metres out, that jump. And it's a bit like in golf, you know, John Daly, for instance, was known as the biggest hitter. If John Daly suddenly started hitting the ball 300 yards instead of 350 yards, so I was talking about golf, then people would be disappointed. People would be disappointed, even if John Daly was becoming a better player. And what Cavendish has become is a better cyclist. Has he become a better sprinter? Probably not. He might have regressed slightly as a sprinter.
So what kind of races can he target then, Lionel?
Well, I thought the most interesting thing about the uphill finish was that it suggested that his climbing is better, his power obviously up, weight probably down. A lot of the work he was going to do over the winter was going to be about making sure he kept off the winter weight, which he has put on a little bit. I think, Daniel, you'd probably know better than me, but that was one of the things, certainly last year and the year before. So he started the season fitter, stronger.
Sounds like a Radiohead song.
Yeah. And
more productive.
And to take the golf analogy, you know, he's definitely on par at the moment, isn't he? He's not quite he's not quite under par. He's not getting birdies and eagles yet, but he's certainly scoring the correct number of shots per designated
hole. Not in the bunker, like the Alcatraz. Yeah. A lot of sand there.
Just on Cavan, the lead out, we talked a lot about... actually, funny you should mention golf, because Ciro... The best friend of the podcast, Ciro Scognamiglio, made his debut at a golf... I believe that was Ciro's first experience of covering a golf tournament, because the European Tour was there in the same week as the riders in Dubai. Anyway, we're talking about Cavendish. We talked a lot last week about Sabatini, where he fitted into the lead-out train.
Fabio Sabatini.
Yeah, the new signing from Cannondale. And we talked about Tony Martin, Renshaw. There was an interesting couple of still photos flying around today on Twitter, just showing how Cavendish is still the... When it comes to getting close to his lead-out man, he's still absolutely second to none. It just showed the difference in space between the wheels between Cavendish and Viviani, who he was going up against most days Dubai.
There's more than one way to win a sprint, isn't there? And I thought what was interesting, stage four in particular, which is when the lead-out train seemed to really click into gear for Cavendish, one of the first and only times that's really happened at Quickstep, I think, in 3 years. This is his third year there, isn't it? And you know, they became detached from the rest of the bunch, Renshaw and Cavendish, and there was a mistake there by the United Healthcare rider, let the wheel go. You could say that was a mistake, or you could say that it was the speed that they generated. You know, they were flying those last 3 kilometres.
It was exactly what Gaviria had done to Cavendish one day at the Tour de San Luis 10 days earlier.
Just to answer your question, Richard, which I didn't answer just before, about which races Cavendish can target, I think everything is leading in the first phase of the season towards Milan-San Remo, and that's why John Degenkolb also being up there, also doing well on the punchy finish.
Last year, we thought that a new climb would be inserted into the route and it would make the route a lot tougher. The Pompeiana, that's not happened. Looks like the route now might remain as one of the easiest, well, certainly the easiest Milan-San Remo route for the last 20, 25 years. Without the Pompeiana, without Limania. So it's actually quite a flat race. But Degenkolb is definitely, I think he's the second favourite now. Peter Sagan is the favourite.
He's an unusual rider, Degenkolb, isn't he? I mean, that was a terrific win at the top of that climb, because he is a fast finisher, but he is a decent climber. If you look at the guys that he beat, you know, the likes of Valverde and people like that, they're real specialists on that type of finish. And I wonder if he's thinking as well about, you know, even extending his repertoire beyond the, you know, Milan-San Remo, Gent-Wevelgem races like that. I mean, he can clearly, you know, can he not develop into a Tour of Flanders rider or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think, remember when we spoke to David Miller last year about Peter Sagan, he just said that there's such a glut of this type of rider now who can get over quite difficult climbs, the likes of Sagan, Degenkolb, Christophe, Matthews, and you almost, you know, sympathise.
He was up there in Paris-Roubaix, of course, wasn't he, last year?
Yeah.
Degenkolb.
And you kind of sympathise with those guys because the competition is really intense. We talked about Matt Goss last week. That's one of the reasons I think he's suffered the last 2 or 3 years. All these new guys have emerged. Just on Degenkolb quickly, I know Etix Quickstep would absolutely love to have him in their classics team, and I think you should watch this space as far as that's concerned.
Just lastly on Degenkolb then, last year he rode Paris-Nice, very impressive there. Won, I think he won the stage on the Magny-Cours motor racing circuit there. He looked really good. Everyone was talking him up for Milan-San Remo. It'll be interesting to see. I know the provisional lists have are starting to come out for Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico. Traditionally, if you're going for Milan-San Remo, the wisdom is that you would ride Tirreno-Adriatico, so it'll be interesting to see if he does Paris-Nice again this year.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, it's a shorter episode this week because it's the first week of our Friends special podcast. And in this last little part, we were going to reflect on Rohan Dennis's hour record. Just after Jack Bobridge, his Australian countryman, failed to beat the record set by Matthias Brändli, Rohan Dennis in Switzerland did set a new mark, 52.491 kilometres, starting to get up to what it was in the early 90s or the mid-90s. But not a great surprise. Did you watch much of it, Lionel? You're a big fan of sitting on the sofa and watching the hour record.
Yeah, I watched the first 10 minutes. No, I didn't. I watched all of it, Richard. Yeah, I mean, it was a much better TV production than the Jack Bobridge, which suffered from not having any graphics on the screen. They really sort of made it easier to follow. You knew what time he was on. The commentators were good at, you know, making sure that you knew roughly where he stood in relation to Brändli's original record. And it struck me watching it how really important these events are becoming for the brands that are supporting the riders. So in this case, BMC Racing. There was a lot of airtime for Andy Rees, the boss of BMC, who owns the bicycle manufacturing company as well. Jim Okovich was there.
That's what it stands for, isn't it? BMC, Bicycle Manufacturing Company.
It does indeed. And you know, this you can imagine. I mean,
that's as unimaginative as the cycling podcast.
We've got the same brand consultant on board, obviously. You know, Movistar and Sky, or Wiggle, whoever it ends up being that Bradley Wiggins is riding for when he has his attempt. You know, there's an awful lot of marketing value in these events, I think. You know, you get an hour of sort of captive audience. Nobody else is getting any airtime at all. And in that sense, people are a lot wiser to the benefits of. If you think back to the 90s when Chris Boardman was riding a non-production bicycle, Graham O'Bree was making his own bicycle at home. The UCI were being very draconian about the rules of what equipment could be used. Everyone's a lot more savvy now, and I think that the hour record has re-established itself as a proper thing.
That might be it until Wiggins has a go, we think, in early June.
Yeah, Wiggins was quoted in L'Equipe today. I don't know whether the quotes were published elsewhere. He spoke to Chris Boardman recently, and he asked Chris Boardman how hard the hour record was, and Boardman apparently replied, well, it depends whether you want to just beat Brändli's record or Dennis's record now, or you want to put it out of sight and put it at 55 kilometres an hour. Dennis, as a character, fascinates me because I know he's a very volatile character, supposedly one of cycling's great hotheads, along with Andrew Talansky. I saw evidence of this in Dennis's case last year at the Vuelta. The last stage finished in Santiago de Compostela, and it was very wet. It was an evening time trial, and there'd been kind of tape put across the line. The finish line had been moved, so a new finish line was created with tape, and Dennis came along, came over the line, and his front wheel slipped on this kind of vinyl tape, and he sort of somersaulted over his handlebars, and he went absolutely ballistic at the organisers. There was a sort of 5-minute rant when he came over.
You didn't happen to catch that on your recorder, did you,
no,
Daniel? You're normally
no,
quite good at these moments with Talansky at the Tour. You managed to catch his outburst on your recorder, but you weren't surreptitiously recording this. That's a shame. Well, that's interesting, because he doesn't, for those of us not so familiar with Dennis, and you know, we know him as a team pursuiter. He's finished second, I think, to Wiggins at the Tour of California last year. So
he's been described to me as the John McEnroe of professional cycling.
He
if he's the John McEnroe, I think Andrew
guy.
Talansky might be the Jimmy Connors.
Well, if Dennis in his red and black striped BMC jersey, I think US marketing guy would probably already be nicknaming him Dennis the Menace, surely.
Absolutely, yeah. No, absolutely. He's a little dog gnasher. Actually, Daniel, you're Remen. You look you got a sort of Dennis the Menace hairstyle,
yeah,
haven't
true,
you? Or gnasher. So, yeah, Alex Dowsett, as we've said before, sadly has postponed his Our Record attempt. But it's definitely back, you know, it's back on the agenda. And as you say, there might be pressure from sponsors on the likes of Cancellara. Tony Martin doesn't really show
everyone,
much
no
interest.
One's talking about Thomas Dekker.
Thomas
you talked
Decker.
About the high production values Decker. Of the TV coverage. I suspect that Thomas Dekker's might be a little bit more sort of down at heel than some of the others.
But it's funny, I mean, his effort was announced by the UCI the other day. The UCI have a strange role in this as well, where they're almost promoting the attempts.
It's they like are they branding all, it the UCI Our Record, aren't they? Mm. They, you know, having really sort of been the major player in ruining the whole thing for years, they've now really got on top of it and they
taking
are
ownership.
Making it. Yeah, but Thomas Dekker going at altitude in Mexico, you know, again, I think Michael Hutchinson said on Twitter that it's a shame that there's already going to be an effort at altitude because they are, you know, when you're 1,500 metres up in the sky, you know,
I can remember
change things a bit.
I've spoken to Chris Boardman about this, and when I discussed Eddie Merckx's 1972 Our Record with Chris, and that, of course, was in Mexico at altitude, and Chris's view was that the advantages and disadvantages kind of balance themselves out. The sort of thinner air, okay, it's easy to go through, but it's harder to breathe, and he felt that it was a pretty even trade-off.
Interesting. Well, we should cut it short, I think. We'll play you a little bit of Chris Froome interview, which features in greater length in the special Friends podcast, which will be available 24 hours after this one goes live. So here's a little bit from Chris Froome.
I think there was actually a point, I think it was after the time trial, a couple of days after the time trial, I was really on my knees at one point, mountaintop finish, and I was just sort of struggling to stay up with the lead guys, and I think I was sort of yo-yoing off the back, and every time I went off the back, all I could think of was, I'm not getting on that bus for the next 10 days, having lost 5 minutes on GC and kind of just rolling around for the next 10 days to just finish the Vuelta. I want to be in this to at least have that battle for the leader's jersey. And as much for my teammates' motivation, I'm not going to get on that bus with everyone just sort of down in the dumps and no morale in the team. So for me, that gave me a lot of motivation to get stuck in and to keep pushing.
And a reminder that you can download details of our Friends podcast on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. I think that's all for us for this week. We'll be back next week with a full-length episode. But Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.